A very good morning to everyone. Before we begin our session today, the court would like to introduce to the members of the bar a guest in our midst. We have the honor of having on the bench with us today the Honorable Tomaki Sasse, a judge of the District Court in Tokyo. Judge Sasse is presently a visiting scholar at the University of Notre Dame and will be returning to Japan in about 30 days after having spent a year in this country observing court and studying American law. Judge Sasse, we are indeed honored to have you with us today. We hope you have an enjoyable stay here in Chicago and observing the court. And I'm sure I speak for all the members of the bar and the bench in Chicago here in welcoming you. With that said, we can turn to the call of the morning. And the first case is number 03-3789 of the United States against Brian Keller. Mr. Hessler.
May it please the court, Judge Ripple, Judge Mannion, Judge Evans, Judge Sasse. The prosecution in this case represents new territory in the assertion of federal power under the Commerce Clause. Not only is this the quintessential local gun case, but a state prosecution was completed before the federal prosecution began. We recognize that this court has previously ruled many times on the question of whether a normal felon in possession case is acceptable under the Commerce Clause. What makes this case different is a completed state prosecution and a lack of any other factors suggesting a stronger interstate nexus. There are several reasons why a completed state prosecution makes a difference. First, a re-prosecution has a far greater impact on state court practices than bringing an original federal court prosecution. With every case that the federal government brings that has already been prosecuted by the state, the state's job of getting convictions and guilty pleas becomes much more difficult.
Would your argument be the same if he was acquitted in state court?
My argument would be much weaker. But the fact that he enters into a guilty plea and a resolution makes the case what it is.
Why would it be weaker if he had been found not guilty?
Because the focus is on what happens, what the federal and state balance is, and there has been a historical expectation that people prosecuted by the state can negotiate with the state. And this kind of practice of bringing a federal prosecution after a local case has been completed means that people will lose faith in the state's ability to actually negotiate anything.
Well, if you're right, then someone could be charged federally, and the lawyer could go and visit the state and say, charge me, and enter a guilty plea before the federal proceedings are finished, and then come to the federal court and say, we have to dismiss the case. It's already been resolved in the state court.
One, that doesn't happen. It's not really possible to get the state to do anything like that.
Oh, why not?
Because the...
A lot of these cases are generated first by the state anyhow.
They are generated, but in terms of a prosecution, they're brought to completion at the point of... by plea negotiations. And... If there were manipulation of the system like that, then that might be a different situation. But that's not what happened here. This is simply negotiations brought in good faith by the state and brought in good faith by Mr. Keller, and then the federal government stepping in and re-prosecuting it. Additionally. State prosecutions do, to some extent, vindicate federal interests. There is the same deterrence punishment in incapacitation, and historically, both the federal government and the state have recognized that those things happening in either system vindicate their interests. And the Supreme Court has always done, has been going through a balancing test on these. And on both hands...
Vindicating interests, though. I mean, I think today in Oklahoma, the state jury is deciding Mr. Nichols' fate and the Oklahoma City bombing case.
That's true.
And they're dual sovereigns.
They are dual sovereigns. However, historically, the federal and state balance has been that each has kept out of their hairs, each other's hair, except when there's exceptional circumstances. And I think Oklahoma qualifies as an exceptional circumstance. Brian Keller's case does not.
Would you admit to exceptional circumstances here, or would you be asking us to draw a bright line rule? If there's been a state prosecution, that's the end of it.
No, I would not. I would be asking you to do what the Supreme Court has done. They have not managed to draw any lines in their cases. They have merely said, in three cases in the last decade, this is beyond the line. And what we're saying is that this is beyond line. The effect on the federal-state balance is greater because of the state prosecution, and the federal interest is less because the state prosecution has already occurred. For those reasons, we ask that you reverse the decision of the district court and remand this. I see my light is on. I'm reserving my time for co-counsel.
Thank you, Mr. Hessler. We'll hear now from Mr. Dice. Is that correct?
Your Honor, I believe we are the
appellee of the cross. You're representing the. I see. Thank you, sir. We'll hear from Mr. Havey at that point then.
May it please the Court, Your Honor, good morning. Brian Havey on behalf of the United States. First thing I want to say is there was a reference in counsel's brief that the government was trying to oversimplify their argument. Let me just say we're not oversimplifying it. We just don't agree with it. I'm puzzled, frankly, by this argument that the federal government can have jurisdiction over a case and then just magically lose jurisdiction once the defendant is convicted in state court. And you can go back over 100 years of Supreme Court precedent and find support, as you referenced, Your Honor, for the dual sovereignty of the state and federal government over the same criminal conduct that's committed by a single defendant. You can go back over 25 years and find support and Supreme Court precedent which establishes federal jurisdiction in gun cases when the firearms previously traveled in interstate commerce prior to the defendant's possession of it. This recent line of Supreme Court cases, these three cases that were decided in the last 5 to 10 years, have raised many false hopes, as this court has stated, for defendants who are trying to get their gun convictions thrown out. Those cases are not analogous here, and it is that simple. Two of those cases involve statutes in which there was no jurisdictional element whatsoever. The third case simply held that when you're talking about arson cases, arsons involving the burning of a private residence that has no connection to interstate commerce. There's no commercial activity being done in the residence. And of course, Congress doesn't have the authority to recognize that. It's a very limited holding. Countless cases have been decided in this very court since those three Supreme Court cases were decided. And each time this court has taken pains to point out that those cases have no impact on felon in possession cases. Once the firearm travels in interstate commerce, jurisdiction is established. Once jurisdiction is established, the federal government doesn't lose jurisdiction, and that's all I'm going to say about that issue, Your Honor. We have appealed the sentence of the district court, the downward departure that the court awarded to the defendant in this case. The standard here is de novo review. The government is deeply troubled by this argument that a defendant who lives in a highly violent environment, who himself has had personal experience with violence, can acquire a firearm in advance, in anticipation of some threatening event, can brandish that firearm, and then come before a court and ask a district court judge to reduce his sentence because of that. The argument that there's some sort of vague coercive force which causes the defendant to go out and get a gun, that's an argument, Your Honor, that has no limits. How many gangbangers and drug dealers can come forward with evidence of how dangerous their lifestyles are and how violent the communities are in which they live? Every day, they have to worry about getting shot at. Should everybody now in those neighborhoods just go out and start arming themselves? I've said it in our brief, and I'll say it again here, this ought to be considered an aggravating circumstance, not a mitigating factor. There are more people getting shot and killed in Chicago today than in Iraq, and the idea that somebody who lives in the Robert Taylor homes or Inglewood, for example, ought to get a lesser sentence than somebody in Evanston. I think if you told the residents in those communities that the law would recognize that, I think it would take their breath away. Why shouldn't we require at least the defendant establish one thing, and that's that there was a legal alternative to acquiring and possessing a gun? We ought not to award mitigation to a defendant who gets a gun as a first response. That is not acceptable. There were alternatives here. The defendant chose not to pursue them. And I recognize that the law does not require the defendant to establish coercion to the level that he would if he was trying to defend himself at trial. He doesn't have to rise to that level. But this case isn't even close to that.
Is there a place where the line could be drawn? I know one of your alternatives is that he can relocate, go somewhere else, away from this. I know what we call the circumstance, the neighborhood he lives in, which is highly dangerous. But what if he, a felon, felt he had to protect his own home and just kept the gun in the home because he was being threatened? People were threatening to get into his home. Does that reach a point where a line could be drawn where obviously it's not legal and he's going to be pinned, but could he get this reduction under those circumstances?
Judge, I'm concerned about trying to draw lines for all cases.
When could this provision apply in your view?
For me, Your Honor, quite honestly, it's hard to imagine a set of circumstances where we should award mitigation to a defendant, especially somebody here who has such an awful record, that they should go out and be able to obtain a gun. It's very hard to distinguish when a gun is going to be used for defensive purposes.
Suppose he was accosted at gunpoint on the street and was able to relieve the assailant of the weapon and took possession of the weapon himself. Held his would-be assailant at bay with the weapon.
Yeah. In that case, Your Honor, I don't think we would have even reached this point. There we might be talking about whether this man ought not be charged at all or ought to be acquitted if he's in the act of self-defense and he wrestles the firearm away.
The case law is fairly stringent on what you have to do to be found guilty of the thing. That's the only reason I asked.
Right. Your Honor, I don't want to dodge the question, but I want to, if I could bring it back to the facts of the case. We're not even close to that. This defendant was here found using the gun in an offensive manner. He was chasing somebody. He was not defending himself. And even the district court made that finding on the record. There was no evidence that he was using this gun in self-defense. As far as we know, the other guy he was chasing wasn't even armed and hadn't even made any sort of threatening approach to the defendant. And he admitted that he had the upper hand on this guy. We can't say when he bought the gun. We can't say he bought it to guard the house, Your Honor. We don't know when he got the gun. We don't even know how long he was going to possess the gun. The only reason the gun was taken away from him was that the police arrested him.
Well, if we're going to focus on facts here, he was down at the beach, right?
That's right, Your Honor.
And he was with a date or something?
He was with his girlfriend.
Yeah, so there he's got a date going to the beach and he has this gun. He then sees someone whom he thinks might be a prior assailant, I guess. And so he takes off after him with the gun.
That's right.
Now that, to me at least, is a little easier set of facts. And I just know, that's why I'm saying, where do we draw the line? You want to draw it.
Right. I would say, Your Honor, I would draw the line at not allowing a departure to be awarded for a defendant in a felon in possession case, in one of these type of cases where the offense conduct itself is possession of a gun. I think these sort of departures are unwise. I think they're not sensible, and I think they ought not to be awarded, in particular for the reasoning of that was given by the district court in this case, that you have this violent neighborhood that a person is living in, and, you know, there may be some justification then for getting a gun. But if that's the case, departures wouldn't be rare. You know, in gang cases and drug cases, these kind of arguments could be made all the time. So I think if we were to start recognizing this as a basis for a departure, I think the guidelines would be gutted in these types of cases, and the most violent people could arguably be eligible for departures that some person that doesn't live in that neighborhood or doesn't have the same experience with violence would be getting a higher sentence, Your Honor. And I don't think that's sound precedent, as we said in our brief. I think, quite frankly, the citizens of those communities, those violent communities, frankly, deserve more protection, not less, and we ought to give it to them. And for all these reasons, unless there's any other questions, Your Honor, we would respectfully request that decision be reversed and that the case be remanded for resentencing.
Thank you, Mr. Hayden.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Bill Tice for Mr. Keller. This case, as far as the government's appeal is concerned, raises two issues. First of all, the standard of review, and then also the application of that standard of review in the context of the gun.
Why don't you start talking about line drawing here? It just seems to me this is a pretty weak case for coercion under any circumstances. If the defendant was actually chasing somebody with a gun at the time.
I think
why do we have to even worry about line drawing here? That doesn't seem like it's coercion to me. He was forced to possess the gun and engage in that activity.
Your Honor, we have to focus on the standard that's set forth in the guideline about the reasonableness of his response, and that reasonableness has to be focused on the offense. Now the government wants to focus just on that day at the beach, but there were other incidents leading up to the day at the beach. And in the statement to the court, it's a typewritten statement which is attached to the request for the downward departure. Mr. Keller talks about, I was in a situation where they weren't going to do this again to me. Now I had the upper hand. But significantly, the man who has the upper hand, instead of shooting the person, gives the gun off to his girlfriend as soon as possible. So we've got this very brief incident where he perceives, and the government has never challenged that. They've never presented anything contrary to that.
Well, there's no evidence that the guy was chasing had a gun.
Of course there is. There's evidence that he perceived himself to be in a state of danger.
But where is the evidence that the person he was chasing had a gun?
There is none, and that is not required under the standard of the guideline. If we make that the standard, then we've gone back to coercion as a legal defense. And the government keeps saying,
well, if he had a gun, why is he running away from somebody? I mean, it's just, we have to take his word for it, that he thought this guy had a gun, so he started chasing him with a gun. doesn't seem to make a lot of sense.
I don't understand why that's so distasteful to the court, that there will be defendants who come forward, present testimony that is uncontradicted, and district courts make decisions based on that. You know, the government says, well, everybody's going to rush in and say they felt threatened. Well, wait a second. We don't know that. Here's someone who came in. He had police reports from two separate incidents, admittedly not from the incident that where he got himself arrested, which the district court found to be credible. That is a far cry from saying, I am an ex-gangbanger living in a gangbanger neighborhood. Please let me have a license to carry a gun for the rest of my life. If that was the claim that he was making, then the government should win. But the government cannot position the case on that basis. That is not the case. There were two very specific, dangerous incidents that actually happened, and the day before he was arrested, he went out and got himself a gun. So we're talking about a possession that is probably less than 24 hours. Maybe it's even 36 hours. And according to his account, which is uncontradicted, he felt himself threatened and dispelled the threat, but didn't hurt anybody with the gun. Now, this court is not going to see cases like that coming before it on a weekly basis. It's not even going to see cases like that coming before it on a yearly basis. These cases are exceedingly rare. And I think that in addition to the line drawing, we really have to keep in mind who's drawing the line and from what vantage point are we looking at the line. It is implicit in the government's position, and sort of between the lines, that they're asking this court to be a sentencing court. What do you three judges think would be the right decision on making this downward departure? But the statute asks you whether or not on the facts that the district court found, which the government has never challenged, on the fact that the district court found, was that departure not justified? So the government has the burden of not only raising the issue, but they have the burden of persuasion. And in attempting to meet that burden of persuasion, all they've really told you is we should never, ever have a downward departure in gun cases where there's possession by an ex-felon. That is their position. I commend them on their honesty. The problem is they should be going to the Sentencing Commission and not to the Seventh Circuit to advance that type of a position. They have chosen the wrong issue. They have chosen the issue that is completely outside the bounds of 3742E. I see my time has run up. I'd love to talk longer, and I suspect you'd like to pepper me with some more questions.
Thank you, Mr. Max.
Thank you.
Does counsel have any more time for rebuttal? Time is expended. In that case, the case will be taken under advisement with our thanks to all counsel.